Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 25th, 2007, and this is show number 84. Well, it looks like I gave QA Director Steve something to tease me about. Last week's feed was titled as February 11th, which was funny, since it should have been February 18th, but the week before, I totally messed up the date when it really was the 11th. I don't know, maybe I felt sorry for the 11th, so I used it twice. But now I feel sorry for the 18th. Oh my gosh, will this downward spiral never end? I hope I label this show right. That's all I can hope for. Hey, you might notice a change to the website. I put in a WordPress plugin that changed all of the audio files to Flash instead of QuickTime. This is easily undone, so if you hate it, let me know. You could also let me know if you prefer it. It does mean you don't have to have QuickTime loaded, which could be a great benefit for many. I know QuickTime is kind of an abomination under Windows, so I don't know, a lot of people hate it. But then again, Bart hates Flash, so maybe people hate that too. I don't know, all these possibilities. But anyway, let me know what you think. It has a little tiny player in there that plays a Flash, and it's kind of right in the same window, so you don't have to leave to another window to hear it. And I do still have a goal of someday having a Flash player that uses the logo made for me by Randy Sakamoto, because it already has a play and fast forward and stop button already on it. Wouldn't that be cool if that logo actually was the player? That'd be awesome. Oh well, I can dream. Someday I'll get that done. Oh, okay, I have a great story. Last night, my neighbor Tammy from across the street called me with this really sad voice. She said, "Oh, Allison, something awful's happened." Well, my heart stopped, worried that maybe her daughter had gotten hurt or something. And I asked her what happened, and she said, "Oh, I bought a computer without talking to you." Well, now I'm not worried anymore, but I'm curious, because I had been urging her to get a Mac, but her husband is dead set on Windows. I asked her why this was such a bad thing, and she said, "Well, when we got home and opened it, it had Vista on it, and now I can't get anything to work. I can't even get it to work on our cable modem. What am I going to do?" Well, she went on to explain that she had called the Costco concierge desk where she had bought it, and the guy there told her that all kinds of stuff won't work, not her iPod or her Palm, and she was just really freaked out about it. Well, today I went over to the Palm website, and I did find that certain versions do work with Vista, but I know that Vista and iPods definitely don't mix. I'm pretty sure I saw something that Apple actually came out with a thing saying that it would break your iPod, so you definitely don't want to have Vista and your iPod in the same room. Well, she asked me if I still had a PC for sale. See, I'm selling the one I built a few years ago because nobody's using it. Everybody prefers the Macs around here, so sure, her husband walked right over to pick it up. Well, I was handing it to him, and I was telling him about all the great features, and I explained to them what I thought it was worth, and he said, "I don't care what it costs, as long as it doesn't have Vista on it." You gotta know how much I enjoyed that. Well, unfortunately, I forgot I had a password on that machine, so they didn't bother me last night, and they just gave it back to me this morning. But the good news was that they said that they're going to buy a Mac after all. I bet they won't do it. They'll flinch and get a Windows machine, but at least they're thinking about it. And the whole story gave me such a good giggle, it was worth it. All right, enough gloating. Time to get to work here. I was whining to Bart about how I wish that QuickTime would play AVI files. And he asked me why I don't just use VLC, Video LAN Connection, from videolan.org. Well, I do use VLC, and I use it to watch AVI files, and it's a pretty good program, which has been improved greatly over the years. But it seems to take quite a long time to launch my files, and frequently it seems to crash on opening, like maybe one out of five times. It always works the second time I try it, though, which is kind of odd. And it does also seem fond of nagging me with these weird connection errors. If I pause a movie or I do some other dastardly deed, it considers worthy of a warning. Well, Bart answered my needs with a program called Perian from perian.org. That's perian.org. Perian enables QuickTime application support for additional media types, including AVI and FLV, that's Flash, by the way, DivX, Flash Screen Video, and a whole host of others. I downloaded and installed Parian, which, by the way, has a quick, cool logo, looks like a Swiss Army knife. I launched QuickTime and asked it to open an AVI file, and it worked perfectly. That's all I had to do. I just installed it, and boom, I'm online. Well, Bart does a much more in-depth description of Parian, so I don't want to snake his thunder on his blog. Wait, is it steal his thunder or and snake his idea? I get those mixed up. Anyway, go check it out at his blog at bartbouchatz.ie/blog. Follow the link in the show notes if you can't spell Bouchatz for some reason. I can't. Well, it's time for a word from our sponsor. Honda Bob asked me if I'd tell you about his cousin who does the illustrations sprinkled here and there around the site. His cousin actually does much more than the little silly doodles that are there, and I read up on it on from Bob's website. Patrick Richard is an artist whose drawings are extraordinary. He brings to life people and scenes. His artwork has been displayed at several galleries on the East Coast. He's available to draw any subject of your choosing, no job too small. Well, the biography on Bob's website, according to Patrick, is, I expand the view of a person's face to include sunlit mahogany floors that engage the shadows of a distant, darker room, backlit lace, heirloom paintings of delicate romantic light play, to pass down through your generations, draws, paints, prints well, inks, ponders, oil paints, can do, will do, college, yes, art associations affiliates, yes, New Hampshire, is good, honest, stops to smell the roses, wants you, returns inquiries, and doesn't tailgate. In other words, my bio is not degradable. Class, and like Honda Bob, mobile. I liked his bio. Well, I took a look at Patrick's paintings on Bob's site, and they're really extraordinary. They really are. To see his beautiful work, go to the link I put in the show notes, because it's a little complicated. My favorite is the one of Einstein. I have a weakness for Einstein. Listener Leo told me about a really cool way to get help on your Mac and give back to the community. It's called NoWonder.com. NoWonder is based on the help people in the Mac community seem to be willing to give each other. First, there are the forums, which are pretty active, but there's also a team of technical help all made up of volunteers. Leo is one of those volunteers, and he says he really enjoys it when he gets a question he can answer and can help someone out. He was able to have the questions that go to him tailored towards the things he knows best, iPods and designing websites and iWeb. He's quite a specialist in those areas. Well, I poked around and discovered that No Wonder is also mirrored at macOSX.com. Not quite sure why they have two URLs that point to something almost identical. They just have a different name and the theme is slightly different, but it's actually the same content. In any case, Bart really recommends the site for getting quick tech support to help on your problems. Check it out at nowonder.com or macOSX.com. Well, I was feeling bad that I hadn't done any Windows freeware or shareware recently, and I came across a cool application called VDownloader, which is available from softpedia.com. VDownloader is a freeware tool that allows you to download YouTube, Google, and GrinV videos onto your computer in MPEG or AVI format, doing the conversion from FLV for you. Well, this is just the kind of tool we've been finding on the Mac, so I was excited to bring one to our Windows brethren. I was a little nervous about the software because while I normally like to direct people to the developer site, in this case Enrique Puertas, but I checked it out and it was all in Spanish. Nothing wrong with that, of course, but I couldn't begin to tell you what the site is about, because I'm an ugly American and I speak only one language. So I thought it might be safer to download from Softpedia. The download took forever, even though it's only a 1.82 megabyte file, but it came down at like 7K per second, so go get a cup of coffee while this one downloads. All right, so I finally got the darn thing downloaded, and it launched StuffIt Expander under Windows. But StuffIt Expander told me I'd been using the demo version for 282 days longer than I was allowed. All right, no big deal. I should be able to open it with something else, right? Well, I noticed at this point that it's a RAR file, R-A-R, but I figured I'd be able to figure out how to open that thing out, right? Wrong. So very wrong. Because in order to do that, I'd have to be able to find the darn file I downloaded. I checked to see if I had a downloads folder on Windows. Nope. I hunted around on the desktop. Nothing there. I went into Firefox, which was where I downloaded it from, and I looked in the preferences to see if there was a folder designated that I should be downloading to, but it said I was downloading to the desktop. I went back to the desktop, looked some more, looked in column view, nothing. Well, at this point in the story, I have to formally apologize to my brother Grant. Of the four siblings, he's the only one who insists on using Windows. So many times I've thought that he was just lame at computers, because he told me he downloaded stuff, and then he didn't know where it was. Behind his back, I must admit, I had unkind thoughts about his intelligence. I might even have thought the word idiot at some point. Well, after this experience today, I have to declare my brother Grant not an idiot, at least on this topic. So, bottom line is, if you want a free flash download program for Windows, go over to softpedia.org and do a search on vDownloader. And then just go for a walk in the park and play with a stray dog, because you're never going to be able to find it after you download it. In 1769, Hungarian nobleman Wolfgang von Kempelen astonished Europe by building a mechanical chess-playing automation that defeated nearly every opponent it faced. A life-size wooden mannequin adorned with a fur-trimmed robe and a turban, Kempelen's Turk was seated behind a cabinet and toured Europe, confounding such brilliant challengers as Benjamin Franklin and Napoleon Bonaparte. To persuade skeptical audience, Kempelen would slide open the cabinet's doors to reveal the intricate set of gears, cogs, and springs that powered his invention. He convinced them that he had built a machine that had made decisions using artificial intelligence. What they did not know was the secret behind the mechanical Turk, a human chess master cleverly concealed inside. Why am I telling you all of this? Well, Amazon has created a website called Amazon Mechanical Turk at mturk.com that is a modern version of the old idea. The thing is, today we know how to build computers and write software that can solve incredibly complex problems, like playing chess. But humans are still better than the most advanced computers at things that seem trivial for us, like identifying things in photographs. mturk.com is a website where computers provide the questions they can't answer, and you can go in and give them the answer, and then they continue on their merry way in executing the tasks they've been given. And get this, you get paid for it. Now, think about how disturbing that is. You can actually work for a computer. Yikes. Well, here's an explanation from the site. Amazon's Mechanical Turk provides a web services API for computers to integrate artificial intelligence directly into their processing by making requests of humans. Developers use the Amazon Mechanical Turk web service to submit tasks to the Amazon Mechanical Turk website, approve completed tasks, and incorporate the answers into their software applications. To the application, the transaction looks very much like any remote procedure call. The application sends the request, and the service returns the results. Behind the scenes, a network of humans fuels this artificial intelligence by coming to the website, searching for and completing tasks, and receiving payment for their work. Well, if you're interested in having your work assisted by the Mechanical Turk, they show on the site how to put the code to call mturk.com and how to set yourself up with this. I'm not a developer, so I'd look at how to make my fortune at mturk.com instead. First, you find hits to work on. Hits are human intelligence tasks. These are tasks someone is willing to pay you to complete. An example they give you is there a pizza parlor in this photograph? Just for doing this one task, you can earn a nickel. Yeah. How could I resist an offer like that? Well, I went ahead and logged in with my Amazon account and then had to give them a valid phone number and address. Not a big deal. It's the same account that I use for Amazon anyway. Next was the agreement to approve. I read a bit of it and found this nice sentence. We have no control over the quality, safety, or legality of the services. Found that interesting. So if someone uses this as a scam to get past CAPTCHAs, for example, am I aiding and abetting? Better keep a watchful eye over what it's asking me to do. Well, the first one I looked at was asking you to identify signs on a street as signs. So I doubt there's any big drug kingpin behind that one. Good to be alert, though, right? All right, now that I'm in, I can choose to look at the hits available to me. I can choose to sort them by creation date, by time allotted to complete the task. The one about the signs had 8,612 hits available, but only 2 hours to complete it. Not ready for that kind of pressure on my first day on the job. Well, you can also sort by highest award amounts or lowest. I checked out highest, and it was a dollar. Woohoo! Then I found out that this particular hit was you had to go check out a specific book from the library, read it, and jot down quotes of 15 to 60 words in length. The quotes should be meaningful in that they should provide some insight into the human condition or the natural world. Now, you only have to do 5 to 10 quotes, but you have to include page references as well. If you get at least 5 acceptable quotes, you make a whole dollar. I suppose if it's a good book that you enjoyed reading, getting a buck out of it might not be a bad idea. Well, of course I'm too lazy to go to the library, though, so let's sort by least number of hits in a request. I found one with one hit from Predictoid. It asked a very easy question. All it wanted to know was whether the stock market will close up or down for the day on Tuesday, February 27, 2007. How utterly bizarre. The next hit was from the same company, asking about another day. They only pay me a nickel if I guess right. I'm dumbfounded in why someone would want to pay a nickel for a stranger's guess. Maybe they're testing an algorithm and they plan on doing a real job later? I don't get that one. Well, I did go on ahead and complete one hit. It gave me a link to a blog posting and asked a series of questions about it. Basically, all I had to do was cut and paste the text from the blog into some fields. It looked to me like this one was trying to do some research on what people were posting about CES. So what I had to paste in was the title of the post, who wrote it, and here was where you needed a human, was they wanted to know, did the person actually say they went to CES? Well, this guy had put a photograph looking out his window in Las Vegas, which meant he was actually there. So I was able to answer yes to that. It asked how many comments they had, that kind of thing. Well, I figure it took me about 2 minutes to decide and then complete it. I think I made about 6 cents for that time, so it looks like I made $1.80 per hour. Oh, well. I think I've given you a flavor for how varied the requests can be at mturk.com. Go check it out if you want some spare change for working for the machine. All right, it's time for our Google products review. We are up to Google Part 13. Can you believe how long we've been going on this? It's a quarter of a year now. Jeez, these guys are busy. I gotta be running out soon, you would think. All right, this next Google tool is kind of like Google Transit that we reviewed a couple of weeks ago. It's called Google Ride Finder, and it's available at labs.google.com/ridefinder. The idea is that with Ride Finder, you'll be able to locate taxi and shuttle locations in one of the 14 cities they've populated. Los Angeles is one of the 14 cities, so I decided to check it out. By the way, they said Los Angeles, but they meant the greater Los Angeles. It's about, 5 hours tall in L.A. traffic time. Well, I went to college at UC Irvine, and UC Irvine was in the span of this, and I lived in Newport Beach at the time. I thought I'd see if I can find a ride between those two. I zoomed in on the UC Irvine campus and found a little gray flag pretty close by, but sort of actually on the 73 freeway. When I clicked on it, I got the phone number for the California Yellow Cab Company. I noticed the same little gray flags sprinkled around the area, some down in Newport, and a bunch of them on the 55 freeway down to Newport. But it turned out they were all for the California Yellow Cab Company, all with the same phone number. I sure don't get what value it was to repeat these all over the place, especially since a bunch of them were kind of right on top of each other. They didn't show the bus routes, and they didn't have any shuttle services. But they did show up on the zoomed up page a list of taxis and shuttles that were not for the local area. I looked around other areas, and it's pretty much a listing of taxi services. Nothing more. Well, I think you can skip Google Ride Finder for now. The next one's a little more fun, though. Next up on the list from within the labs is Google Personalized Search at google.com/psearch. Personalized search asks you for your Gmail or Google login, and then something really scary comes up. Everything I've ever searched for on Google is there in a list. I'm not kidding you. This is so creepy. Months and months of searches are all neatly collated by how I search for them and when. It shows detail on links if you clicked on them from the search. For example, I looked up my son's PC case yesterday. Remember, I'm selling it. In personalized search, it shows that I looked up the NZXT Guardian Green case at 7:40 p.m. It shows the link on which I found it, and it even shows the image I brought up. It also shows things I looked up but didn't end up clicking on. There's a calendar on the upper right, and I can click on any day going back months back at least. I got bored clicking back after I was back 6 months, and I can see what I searched on in that day. On the left side, there are filters of what history I want to look at. I can choose to filter by images, news, frugal, things like that. At first, I thought it was kind of annoying to work with, though, because it starts off searching for all the categories. And if you want to turn them all off but one, I thought you had to click on each one of them to turn them off. But eventually, I figured out there was a button at the bottom that said remove items and turn them all off. And then I could go back and just turn on the ones I wanted. I could also click a button that said select all. You can even do searches within your searches. I tried doing a search on Guardian, the name of the PC case, and it came up with the case, but also all of the places the word Guardian was used in the results of my searches over time. Well, I'm a pretty forgetful person, so I can see how Google personalized search could come in really handy for somebody like me. But it's still really kind of creepy to actually see it in such vivid clarity that they really are keeping all of our search histories. I mean, we knew that, but it's kind of just unsettling to see it for yourself. So, the real question is, how am I me? You know, how does it know I'm me? Is it what I search on this computer? Or does it somehow know who I am? I have a Gmail account, but lots of times I'm not logged in. Would my searches be available from when I wasn't on that account? I could do some elaborate experimentation to determine the answer from these burning questions, or I could hope one of you had time to burn and would do it for me. Or perhaps you already know the answer. Well, listener Bill mentioned that he really hates iTunes. And I've heard that a lot of other people hate it too, or it doesn't do things quite the way they want it. I'm not sure what people hate about it, but it doesn't really matter because it's how you feel that really does matter. If you're not happy with the tool, you should change it. Doesn't matter if I like it or your neighbor likes it. If it doesn't make you happy, then it's wrong. Computers should make you happy. That's all there is to it. Well, when I was noodling on Bill's dissatisfaction, I found a solution in the oddest place. My son gave me a copy of his high school newspaper, and they had an article about open source tools of all things. I was really surprised. That's pretty progressive, I thought. It was frustrating to read, though, because they got some fundamental facts wrong. Like in part of the article, they said that Safari was built on Internet Explorer 6, which, no, it isn't. But when I got past the misinformation, the basic message was reasonable, that going to open source tools like Firefox and Thunderbird was a good idea. The really fun part was that I learned about an open source, cross-platform application for use instead of iTunes, and I'd never heard of it. It's called Songbird from songbirdnest.com. Songbird runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux in 30 languages, and it even supports 64-bit under the GNU public license. Hey, if that didn't catch your attention, the guy from Grease Monkey has a quote on the site that says, Songbird promises to be the Firefox of media players. How's that for a professional endorsement? Seriously, there's an add-on section where developers have created cool things you can add to Songbird. But I get ahead of myself. Let's talk about what Songbird does out of the box. I downloaded and installed Songbird, and when it came up, it asked me if I wanted to import my iTunes library. I was kind of worried that it might copy my iTunes library, which would probably fill up my disk drive, so I said no and figured I'd play around with it with no music in it, maybe move in a couple of songs or podcasts to see how it worked. Imagine my delight when I got Songbird open and in the library I could see all of my music. Told me it was scanning for media and had a checkbox where I could choose to have it scan for new media upon opening. This is cool. because if I get a new podcast in iTunes, it looks like it will show up in Songbird. The look of Songbird is kind of harsh in my opinion. It comes up with a black background with stark white letters and different shades of gray to help you see the rows more clearly. Well, I like a black stark look, but this is somehow busy instead of elegant. The good news is that you can reskin your Songbird. In this case, they cutely call them feathers instead of skins. Songbird comes with two feathers, rubber ducky, which is the one I described, and dove, which is very white with light gray accents to show the rose. This feather is a little too white for me because it looks more like a text window than an application. I'll have to search around for more feathers, but let's get into the capabilities. As I said, Songbird shows my entire iTunes library, with the exception of my protected AAC content bought from the iTunes store. I guess that makes sense. I tried launching one of my MP4 files that I downloaded from YouTube and converted from Flash, and it came up beautifully in Songbird. I really liked what they called the window that opened for it. It was titled Cheesy Video Window. I like a sense of humor. One question I'd really like to have answered is whether Songbird requires QuickTime to work. If it doesn't, then maybe Songbird would be a much better solution for Windows users, since, as I mentioned before, QuickTime 7 is so dreadful under Windows. There are so many horror stories of how hard it is to get it to work, which messes up iTunes if it's not working, so it sure would be nice if Songbird solved that problem. Songbird has a nice navigation section up on the top where you can view by artist and album, and you can search within the library easily. There's a couple of useful buttons across the bottom of the window. If you have a track selected, for example, you can play, remove, edit, or add it to a playlist. That added to a playlist right there is pretty neat. That could be handy. I didn't have any playlists created yet in Songbird, so when I clicked on it, it kind of opened an empty window, but it had a button right there where I could create a new playlist. Nice feature, very intuitive. Now is probably a good time to mention that Songbird is not even close to a released product yet. It's version 0.2.1, and they refer to it as a developer preview. Here's what they say on the download page. Note, Songbird isn't ready for everyone just yet. Songbird will be a drop-in replacement for your current desktop media player upon launch of Songbird 1.0 due in 2007. I gotta tell you though, for a 0.2 product, it is really very polished and very capable. The first indication I had that it isn't ready for prime time was when I tried to see how it would treat an iPod, but I couldn't find any way to tell it to look at the iPod. There was a devices section, but it said no devices. I opened up Help, which opened inside Songbird, by the way, not launching a browser or the stupid Apple Help, and it had an FAQ titled, "Will Songbird work with my favorite portable music device?" To which they answered, "We don't have support for any devices yet, but we are working on it." All right, let's get back to what Songbird can do. Of course, I had to check and see if it would do podcasts. There's a section in the left sidebar that is called MP3 Blogs, which sounded like a new name for podcasts. It was pre-populated with six MP3 blogs, none of which I'd ever heard of before. They came up with a nice view of the blog in the top half, and below that they'd have the playable tracks. I checked out Scissor Kick, which had a song called Eleanor Reggae Rigby, which was pretty interesting, sort of a mashup of Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles with some reggae mashed in there. The buttons at the bottom changed to include Download, Subscribe, Add to Playlist, and Add to Library. I liked them originally, but it's even cooler that they're contextual and change when you're in a different menu. Now, I wanted to try and add a podcast of my own. Say, like, oh, I don't know, the NoSillaCast, just to pick one at random. Under File, I found New Subscription, and that gave me the opportunity to enter the RSS feed URL, which I happen to know by heart, but you would have to go hunt down on my website, which isn't really too user-friendly. I also had to designate a download folder, which was actually nice because I like to know where it's putting stuff. Just like Windows, right? Anyway, pile up stuff, it certainly did. I looked in the folder I created for the Songbird stuff, and it had downloaded 20 episodes of the podcast by the time I looked. That's just crazy. There really does have to be a way to tell it some other number, like 5 or 1, don't you think? When I went back later, there were actually more. I looked at Songbird, and it was continuing to download all of the NoSilicasts from 2005 forward. As you might recall, we're on episode 84, so I removed them in Songbird before it could fill up my entire disk with those files. No album artwork came through, but then again, I didn't see any for the real albums either, so maybe they just haven't built that part. By the way, it did not put NoSilicast in MP3 blogs. It's sort of a standalone thingy sitting up there in the library. Well, it was at this point that I stumbled across an easier way to subscribe to a podcast in Songbird. At the top of the window where you can see the library name, for example, it turns out you can actually type URLs in there. I typed in podfeet.com, and it came up with a view much like what I saw in MP3 blogs. The top half was the website, the bottom half was the playable tracks. Again, there was the subscribe button, and I got exactly what I got before by typing in the complicated URL for the RSS feed. Very user-friendly, I take it all back. However, you can probably predict what happened. I now have every episode I ever created downloading again into my machine. Quick, delete, delete, delete. All right, I do have people who say I should prune my RSS feed, that it should not contain every single episode. But the RSS feed, I mean, the whole darn file is only 176 kilobytes, so I haven't really found the motivation. Has this bothered any of you? Or do your podcatchers seem to be able to handle it okay and just give you a few episodes? Well, uncharted territory for me came up when I clicked on services in the menu. I can't even begin to tell you what about 90% of this is. I got a long menu with some of the things that are already in the sidebar, like library, extensions, and directory, along with the names of the six MP3 blogs I told you about. But in addition to that, I find WinJ, Podbop, Idolator, SwedeLife, Monkey Filter Wiki, and other crazy things. Well, of course, you know the one I clicked on had to be Monkey Filter Wiki, which it turns out is an explanation of the MP3 blog listings. I clicked on a few more, and they all seemed to be about completely different topics. And while I did find some nice jazz to listen to, I didn't figure out the pattern of what makes a service. Well, Songbird also includes a mini player, which is nice, so you don't have to have this big old player hogging up your real estate. However, I think they forgot one feature. I couldn't figure out how to move it. It sits happily just about dead center on my screen, just about the last place I'd choose to put it. I tried dragging, command dragging, control dragging, and that darn thing would not budge. It does have a button that lets you open the full player, one to close it, and controls for volume and a slider, so you can move about in the song. Oh, one thing I should tell you, if you're running this on a Mac, it uses the control key, not command key. So just pretend you're on Windows when you're playing in there. Overall, I gotta tell you, I'm very impressed with Songbird, especially since they consider it, like, super beta. It's highly capable. It ran stably for me under both Mac OS X and Windows XP. If you're one of those folks who just doesn't like iTunes, you might really like to try Songbird. Check it out at songbird.nest. Are you bored with the look of your Mac operating system? Do you envy your Windows friends and how they can alter their theme so that everything gets a facelift? Well, I'm the kind of person who likes to change the furniture around in a room, even if it doesn't work very well in the new configuration. I just like the change. So I think this would be fun for me. By the way, my husband doesn't let me ever move the furniture, but I do enjoy that. Well, if you've had all these worries, enter the $20 shareware application Shapeshifter from Unsanity.com. This is what's called a haxi, and read that as mildly dangerous because it messes around in the OS where Apple really doesn't want you to. Sounds good to me. So I downloaded and installed Shapeshifter to use the 15-day trial, and it warned me that I also needed to install the application enhancer. But luckily, it went ahead and did that for me. It offered to show me all the slop it installed, so I took a screen snapshot of it so I could scrape it all out in case the experiment went bad. It showed me where it put all that stuff too, which is pretty important. Once I had it installed, I launched the system preferences, where it had Shapeshifter down under Other, with all the other weird stuff I have loaded, like Flip for Mac, Media Central, Menu Meters, Unplugged, and TextPander. It very quickly told me that Shapeshifter wouldn't work properly unless I restarted or at least logged out and back in. Kind of a pain, but I did it anyway. All right, now what's up? Shapeshifter has 5 tabs. The main tab where you enter your license key. Apply, where you can apply themes, icon sets, cursor sets, and desktop pictures. You also have a download tab, which is critical because it turns out the first thing you have to do is go get some of these here themes, icon sets, cursor sets, and desktop pictures. It doesn't come preloaded with any, just kind of annoying. It should come with something you can switch to just to see how it works. The next tab you have is Preferences, where you can relaunch the Finder, Dock, and Menu Bar status items after you apply a theme. This is a good thing, because each time you load a new theme, you would have to log out and back in to get it to take effect. And I already whined about doing it the first time. You don't want to hear all the whining if I have to do it every time I change the theme. There's another feature there, too. The last tab is called Exclude List, which allows you to add applications you don't want modified by Shapeshifter. I went to the Download tab and clicked on Get More Themes, which took me to the Unsanity website where I could pick from 5 websites with themes. One of them, Res Excellence, was a broken link, but the others had themes from which to choose. I liked Interface Lift the best because it took me right into themes where I could see what they looked like without having to click on them first. The other sites either made me click on each name to see what they looked like, not going to do that, or they linked me to a homepage, and then I had to dig around to find the themes page. The great thing is that Interface Lift has about 150 themes to choose from. That's even more than I'd ever want to switch between. I chose a moderate theme called SETI that made things just a little more gray and calming looking. Once I download it, I had to launch it as a disk image and then double-click the installer. Then I could go back into System Preferences and select the new themes. Any windows or applications that were open when I made the change were not updated, but if I closed and opened them, the new theme was applied. Bottom line, I think Shapeshifter is a fun tool to change up the look and feel of OS X. So if you get bored easily, check it out from unsanity.com. I think if I felt like changing the look of my operating system really often, it'd probably be worth $20. But I'm betting this is the kind of thing I would change it once or twice a year, maybe, and I'm not sure it's really worth $20 for that. It's fun, though, and it turns out there's an XP theme if you really want to make yourself crazy. Well, on that frightening thought, I'm going to wind up this week's episode of the No Silicast. Keep all your great emails coming to allison@podfeet.com. Or if you want to send an audio file, send it on over to nosilicast@gmail.com. And don't forget to stop by the spam-free forums at podfeet.com/forums_bbpress. Hey, wait a minute. Didn't I promise to simplify that? Oh, well. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.